Welcome to the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review, where we will cover all things national security, military, foreign policy, and history. Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Kelsey Herman. Today's guest is current Georgetown adjunct professor, Gina Bennett, and we'll talk about her concept of the hunter and gatherer theory in national security and why going soft could be exactly what the United States needs to be stronger and more secure. Gina M. Bennett is a retired CIA seasoned counterterrorism specialist and member of the Senior Analytics Service who authored the earliest warnings in the 1990s about the growing danger of the movement Osama bin Laden fomented. She served for 34 years in the counterterrorism mission in numerous roles that span both tactical and strategic. Ms. Bennett is often featured in documentaries and other media profiling her role in counterterrorism and as a pioneer for women in national security and intelligence careers, which she now continues as the Strategic Advisor for Girl Security, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization which seeks to empower, secure, and advance young girls into national and international security missions. Bennett is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies, where she teaches both ethics and intelligence support to national security and hunter-gatherer national security. She is a member of the board of directors of the Alturas Institute, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing American democracy by promoting the Constitution, civic education, gender equality, and equal protection of the law. She is the mother of five children who were the source of inspiration for her two National Security Mom books, comparing national security to parenting. She has written numerous articles for a variety of journals. Ms. Bennett earned her bachelor's degree in economics and foreign affairs from the University of Virginia and her master's in security studies as a distinguished graduate of the Marine Corps War College. So, hi, Professor Bennett. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. I'm really excited to jump into this fascinating and important topic with you.
Thank you for having me. I am so excited about sharing hunter-gatherer national security with you and all of your listeners. So thank you.
Absolutely. As I've mentioned to you before, I attended your workshop on the hunter-gatherer theory back in March, and I've honestly not stopped thinking about it since. And what you talked about, it was really a light bulb moment for me that bridged the gap between how we're taught national security sort of in the classroom and what we feel might be missing in some of those conversations. So jumping right in, can you walk us through exactly what is the quote-unquote hunter mindset compared to the gatherer one, and why does this distinction?
Yeah, no, great question. And you hit the nail on the head in terms of what might be missing, because I think that's largely what this theory or hypothesis attempts to answer, that question, what might be missing and how do we bring it back in? So I have to start with a little bit of hunter-gatherer history and anthropology, and that's, you know, one of the things in the classroom is we do read some anthropology, because I don't want to assume that everyone knows our Homo sapien history. You know, our anthropologists tell us that as of now, humans have been around for about 500,000 years, that the vast majority of this time we were in nomadic hunter-gatherer communities. In fact, 498,000 years of that time. So, or 488, sorry. You know, this timeline matters, I think, because we erroneously believe that our ancestors prior to the Neolithic or agrarian revolution didn't really matter, that they had nothing really to teach us about anything modern or, you know, anything that would be relevant for today. I think it's a social and scholarly norm to just assume that political, social, economic structures, those are all the things that emerge, sometimes we call it civilization, out of the settling of our hunter-gatherer nomadic ancestors, that's the relevant history. You know, after we settled, after we turned into civilizations and began creating religions and explaining the world around us, because we obviously had more time to be able to do that by being settled. But, you know, believing that there are no lessons to be learned from the prehistory, so to speak, you know, before civilization is an assumption. It's not an, you know, it's an assumption that I think needs to be examined. And really, even more so because the invention of alphabetic writing itself is only about 4,000 years old. And when you think about it, all of our theories and sciences all are rooted in what has been written in history. You know, all of the alphabetic writing and even some of the cuneiform beforehand, but all of that is pretty recent compared to 500,000 years of social interaction and societal security structures that we think aren't relevant. But when you, you know, when you get to today and you realize our knowledge base, the information and the data and the observations that we draw from is really, it only represents 0.8% of human history. So it's a big, strong assumption. What is it? 99.2% of human history is irrelevant. And, you know, just as a former intelligence analyst, that makes me very, very nervous. So, you know, I just think it's dangerous to go on with that assumption without really challenging it, especially because law and government, security, science, religion, everything is based on this very limited information. I think disregarding the implications and significance of how the agrarian revolution divided us into public spaces and private domiciles is really the big assumption that I'm most concerned with, because prior to that settling, hunter-gatherers, you know, operating in a far more nomadic type of structure, the roles and the contributions that they offered to human survival, to prosperity, to security, were all pretty transparent. You could see what everyone else was doing. And if you were fit for a specific role, then you did it, because our survival did rely on that. But more than just survival, also our advancements, our evolution, our innovations and inventions, all of that was really very transparent. So I think it's the creation of this public sphere where the former hunter moved into and became more of the defender, protector, eventually provider with the Middle Ages, you know, bringing on more industrial farming. And over in the private space, the domicile, where the gatherer was now growing into a more of a caretaker and strategic planner, and you know, for resources and more long-term outlook. So having these two separate spaces with different activities, different contributions to, again, human security and survival is really, I think, where problems developed for security studies and everything else, frankly. So what happens is, you know, you have all of those fabulous things that come out of the public sphere, which we know about, right? Because it's all been written and recorded, or not all, but, you know, we have thousands of years of writing and recording about that. But we don't really look to what the evolution and the survival instincts that grew out of the activity in the private sphere. We don't really look to that. And in fact, we continue to think what happens at home is really only relevant to what happens at home. So I want to make it clear, though, that I'm not talking about gender or birth sex. This is really entirely about the roles. Now, I know that that's hard because, of course, with the settled society, we also saw the rise of the patriarchy and the structures that we are still dealing with around the world today that are very largely male dominated and male default by nature. But that's not, I mean, that's a whole other discussion that I don't really want to focus on. It's important, but my focus is more thinking about those roles, those contributions, the approaches to creating security and maintaining it for a societal structure. Because there are activities that occurred in the home, in the domiciles, that have not been, or that have been dismissed as having relevance for the bigger scaling up public space or eventually nations in the world. So really, I think the fallacy that what happened in the private space has no relevance on law, politics, governance, security, sciences, and even religion is the problem here. And I, you know, why it matters for us today, because I know it sounds like not even ancient history, prehistory. But in America, for centuries, we've conceptualized our national security as the safety of the state. And we get that from Cicero, right? You know, one of those post 4,000, you know, years ago recordings of written history. So we think of national security as safety of the state, integrity of our borders from invasion, protection of our buildings, infrastructure, and our people. You know, since the Cold War, even a little bit before it, with the rise of realist security theories, America, I think, has hyper-prioritized physical military power projection as, you know, our main way of deterring enemies. Now, I'm extremely grateful for that. As a child of the Cold War, having to do the duck and cover because my father was in the military, I appreciate that we were able to deter mutually assured destruction because it was a very pervasive fear. But even during that period of time, I never thought that, you know, if the Soviet Union had fired its missiles and destroyed more than half of the American people, that we would suddenly be like, okay, we'll be communists. Anymore, that's preposterous, right? We would have fought back. And it's the same is true for, you know, like 9/11. And I don't think at any point the American people were going to say, okay, we'll join the caliphate. It's just, it's silly when we think about it, right? But if, you know, if our security rests on the absence of attacks or threats, then, or enemies, we're going to be insecure forever. So I've always believed that our security as a nation rests in our fierce independence of the choice we have in our government and the durability of our Constitution. So that leads me to the second reason why this is all still this public-private divide that occurred, you know, 10,000 years ago, why it's still relevant to America's security today. I think the best way of illustrating it is through a discovery that occurred last year, actually. Some Israeli archaeologists and anthropologists and other scientists were reviewing artifacts that they had already collected some time beforehand. And one of them was a little comb. It was ivory. It was about 3 inches, so very small. And it was, you know, just one of the many artifacts that they had found at some site. And they went back and did some more digging on all of these things. And what they found with the comb in particular was that it had carving in it. So it wasn't just, I think maybe initially they thought it was worn by time, but it was actual carving. And what they discovered was it was alphabetic. And they already knew some of this alphabet. But lo and behold, what they had was an artifact that currently is the oldest form of alphabetic writing that has been discovered. So it's from 1700 BC. So when they did some more digging and they discovered what the writing actually said, it said, "May the tusk of this comb root out the lice in the beard and hair." And they found fossilized lice larvae on it. So this comb was created to get lice out of your hair, your beard, which anyone who's ever dealt with lice, and I have 5 children, so clearly I have dealt with lice. You know, you think of lice as like an annoyance, and it just drives you crazy because it's so hard to get rid of. But in fact, back then, you know, we're talking pre-hygiene, lice could have killed an entire population because a lice infestation is so hard to control. It creates sores on your body or, you know, and ultimately it's almost like creating lesions, almost like leprosy where you decay from the outside in. So when you think about it, a lice infestation is more of an existential threat than a saber-toothed tiger. Because at least the saber-toothed tiger will get full after eating enough people. The lice will not. They will continue to spread and kill. So, you know, the archaeologists and the anthropologists kind of laughed at this little thing because they thought it was funny. You know, the meaning of life was not on this lice comb. But I actually think it is a much more serious and incredibly significant story. Because what it says to me is that there were people, likely our caretaker, you know, strategic planners, who had observed for long enough the sores and how, you know, it affected the people, that they were able to figure out the cause, the root cause being the lice. Now, lice is not something you're going to be able to kill with a spear. So they came up with a different solution, the comb. It worked. And they bothered to write down how to use it on the actual comb. So they observed, they probably collaborated with other people to get even greater observations. They brainstormed and came up with a solution. They shared that knowledge rather than hoarding it. By writing it down, it could be found by anyone who picked up that comb. And by doing so, they learned how to prevent future lice infestations. That is a gatherer, caretaker, planner, or private sphere form of security. Identification of a threat, observation, studying it, learning it, and figuring out a solution that not only would be sustainable, but would actually prevent the future of that threat. That is what we are missing in our national security approaches, because instead they very much focus on the hunter, protector, defender role, which is absolutely equally important, but it is only half the story of how we thrive. And I think, you know, today when you look at America, we're very safe physically. I think second to none when it comes to our military and our power projection and our ability to deter direct physical threats to ourselves. But we have a lice infestation in this country. Americans don't feel secure. 85% of Americans, according to Pew polling, think that our government needs major changes. They think a democracy isn't working anymore. We have a large majority of people who don't even know that we have three branches of government. And I think the Pew polling recently showed that less than 2% of Americans think or trust the government in Washington to do the right thing all the time. That is not consent of the governed anymore. You know, when there is this much political disenfranchisement and alienation and bitter, you know, partisan politics, among other things, you have a safe country, but not a secure nation. So I think that's really kind of the balance between the hunter, protector, defender approach and the gatherer, caretaker, you know, strategic planner approach. Is one is focused on safety and the other is focused on security, defined by that durability and prosperity of the Constitution and the people. That is where I feel we have a lot that we've missed that we can bring in to our security theories and our security approaches, as well as many other things. You know, more and more, I'm concerned about whether or not we're too late in the game for that. But that's really my answer to your question, my very long answer to your question.
No, I love that. I think that's so insightful and important to acknowledge and think about. For everyone, but especially security professionals. And we're going to dig into more of what you said. So, but you talk in your book, National Security Mom, which I did read and it was fantastic.
Thank you. You talk in your book
about how safety, and you also spoke a little bit about this in your answer just now, about how safety doesn't necessarily mean security. So how will, just digging in a little deeper, a quote-unquote gatherer approach better secure the homeland, more broadly generate international stability, more so than the traditional security pathways such as a strong military? So expanding the umbrella of national security beyond the hard security pillars we think of normally. And you did touch on that a little bit, but just an opportunity to kind of expand more on that question.
Sure, yeah. And I'll even go back to one of our earliest realist theorists, Thucydides, you know, who said nations, you know, go to war out of fear, honor, and interest. And I think, you know, the thinking about that or the implications of that have been very much, again, in histories focused on fear of physical threat, you know, fear and the responses to it. But there's another way of neutralizing fear, and that's not being afraid of it. like that sounds real simple, but when I think again about the solutions that we tend to come up with to threats in the private sphere, in the domicile, they don't presume that you can neutralize all physical threat. And so you have to dig deeper, build resilience, build self-value, self-worth, the ability to maintain and sustain, you know, the who you are and what you believe in as an individual, as a family, as a society, as a nation, despite threats, or even with the expectation of them. I don't see that as defeatist. I see that as being realist. So understanding that safety is important, and the national security apparatus that we, you know, particularly the defense structure that we have built around that, provides us with an unbelievable amount of safety compared to other places in the world. It's just amazing. But we can't expect that infrastructure, that architecture, to also provide security. Security comes from learning. Security comes from creating shared values and teaching people how to govern their government. And we clearly haven't done a good job of teaching how democracy works. If we were to look at the 300 million Americans and say, you know, on any given day, we have 300 million people who are governing this country. We need to make sure they have the knowledge to do that. They don't. And it's not because they don't want to. I'm sure most Americans do want to, but it's not happening. It's not being provided. And I don't think you can rely on one civics class in sixth grade and another maybe in 12th grade and think that it's done. Clearly it's not. If most Americans can't even name just three branches of government. If you can't even name the branches, you have no idea how this balance of power is supposed to work, and that democracy is not a winner-take-all, and that we are all supposed to be kind of unhappy with the results because of compromise being required, because our founders actually structured in gridlock to protect us from ourselves. And from people who you want to continue to amass power for power's sake. I mean, that is, I think, one of the brilliant things about the framers is that they had such an intense distrust of human nature's, or the seduction of power for human nature, that they built in these checks and balances in order to prevent any one individual or group of individuals from amassing so much unchecked power that they could turn our country into an autocracy or a totalitarian state. I think you can't expect the same national security, the pieces of the same national security apparatus that are so focused and exceptional at the safety side to be the security side. And I think for far too long, people have expected the military to somehow or another magically produce that sense of security. Well, they do produce a sense of safety. But we need our education department to produce the sense of security. We need everyone, you know, this goes well beyond the government. You know, we're talking about media, social media, nonprofit organizations, international organizations. Everybody has to be involved in the educational process, and it needs to be a priority in terms of even our federal budget. So that is really, you know, from my perspective, you have to first think about the origins of safety and the origins of security, and recognizing that they come from different types of activities. They're complementary. One does not necessarily produce the other. Just like security, we could believe in ourselves and still get wiped out by a nuclear weapon, right? They don't cause each other. They're complementary.
That's great. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Talking a little bit more about you and your journey, you've spent most of your career in the intelligence community, or the IC, which we like to think of as the quote-unquote tip of the spear. It doesn't get much more hunter mindset than that. How did your experience in government lead to this way of thinking for you? Were you observing something or working on a particular project that led to a light bulb moment on how we as a nation should be doing things differently?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, you know, coming from the Cold War, I think it was always nagging at me, you know, this idea of, wait a minute, aren't we more than just the dirt we stand on? Which is really how I started thinking about the way we were approaching national security. And it's more than just semantics to me, you know, it's because those words line up to activities and expectations that are illogical in my mind. But so I think I always had it sort of haunting at me. But, you know, clearly 9/11 was a pivotal moment in terms of how our government and the people rallied around this event, you know, moved a lot of the protector, defender, you know, hunter apparatus to taking, you know, action. And again, I was in counterterrorism, right? So sitting in the middle of this counterterrorism mission, I had always wanted and was passionate about the mission of trying to stop an attack, trying to prevent terrorism. So that never diminished. But what frustrated me is that we never really had obviously the CIA, we couldn't, but our policymakers didn't really have an honest conversation with the American people to explain these attacks. You know, one way to think about the terrorist attacks on the United States, whether here or anywhere else, is that we are influential in the world, and therefore we're going to make enemies. Another way to think about it is, if we weren't the focus of those kinds of enemies, or we weren't influential in the world, then is that what you want? You know, that's the cost of being a leader in this global environment, is that you're going to make enemies. Now, we teach that to our kids, like, if you're going to be a leader, somebody's going to try to take you down, right? I mean, we know this intuitively. It is also true among nations and non-state actors. I was frustrated by the conversations about defeating terrorism and destroying Al-Qaeda and all of these. I understand the fervor. I understand all of that. But it raises false expectations among the American people that we can fund this enough and get the structure of our national security apparatus just right and go acquire all this information and intelligence in the world just so that we will never be attacked. And that is just irresponsible, I think, to leave the American people with that expectation, because then the next attack means, what do we do? What did we do at that point? So it frustrated me that we weren't building in this conversation in order to empower the biggest weapon against terrorism, against adversaries, and that is the American people and their resilience to being in, and their resistance to being influenced by that, their resistance to being afraid of it. Because if we can resist fear, then we can make the decisions about what America wants to do and should do based on us and not the fear. And, you know, so I think it was 9/11 really, it's not 9/11 as much as it is our responses to 9/11 and our missed opportunities to build that kind of resiliency, some shared sense of we're all in this together. And I think, you know, that really is what frustrated me and led me to the book and beginning the research on this theory that I've been developing since.
That's fascinating. I mean, it's great to get that sort of insider perspective of you on the front lines were saying, hey, wait up, we're doing something a little wrong here. There's a missed opportunity here. That's awesome. So sort of in that vein, within your own experience of national security, the apparatus in the U.S., how has the national security community responded to this kind of concept of a paradigm shift? Would you say there's been any pushback?
Oh, yeah. Especially initially, you know, part of the problem of being an analyst exceptionally well trained by CIA is that you tend to be a little bit ahead of where people's conversations are, sometimes really way ahead. And when that happens, you know, I'm used to it. I'm used to the sort of the glazed over eyes and realizing that everything kind of has its time. And, you know, you just build on what you can as you communicate your position or your projection. I'm patient when it comes to all of that. Again, 5 children, obviously I'm a patient person. So, but I do think with the increase in foreign malign influence, with the increase in the technology that has been used to create influence, both good and bad, and the advancements in that and the increased accessibility of it around the world, people have started to talk more and more in security sectors about influence as a threat mainly, but influence, you know, that is not a missile. That is something very different and very hard to shape, let forget control. Again, in the private spaces, that is the power that lasts. Any parent will tell you that you have a short period of time, a window of time to influence and mold how your children think, what they think, how they behave, what they value, you know, what the responses are going to be to challenges to all of that. That's what lasts, right? That role, that influence is a means to securing something much bigger than somebody being afraid of you and behaving because they're going to get a spanking. Instead, you're creating a shared value set and a shared vision for the future that will endure well after you're in the picture. And again, I think those are the sort of security approaches, like I was saying, after 9/11, that we didn't gravitate towards. And I understand why, because they got lost in history 10,000 years ago with the agrarian revolution. So I think it's well past time for us to bring those in. And I do think as now more and more political scientists, security scholars are realizing the threats and of influence, that this is becoming a bit more of a conversation. You add to it more recently the divisions that we've faced in our own country, the doubts that Americans have about the veracity of election results and whether or not their vote counts, all of these additional kinds of threats to security in America, which creates instability everywhere, and not just politically, but also economically, which we all feel back, you know, back home too. I think that has enabled or facilitated a little bit more willingness to think, what are we missing? Again, because we're very safe. So that's all the good news. That's all the, yeah, I think the sort of mental battle space over the past 20 years has grown a little bit more willing to entertain a different security paradigm than the realism one that we have been looking to for so long. However, there is still that human nature impulse to deal with the here and now, to deal with what is tangible, not because the solutions are easier, but because identifying those threats is easier. And so we look at the things that we don't know as well, and we'd rather gravitate toward what we do know. And frankly, we have the structures in our national security apparatus to deal with what we know. And we don't necessarily have the structures to deal with what we don't know. And like I said before, a lot of what's going to tackle of the security side is not within the traditional national security apparatus. So I think it's a better, more realization that we are, you know, realism is not securing our democracy, but still at that, what do we do with that?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So do you think in this era of great power competition, it's a big buzzword these days, where conversations are so focused on defense budgets, applications of new technologies on and off the battlefield, the aggressive rhetoric, we're in danger of losing sight of this nuanced perspective on national security. So are we still too much on the hunter side? And you sort of touched on that a little bit in your last answer.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is a hard conversation, right? Because what I am trying to suggest is balance, not we abandon safety. We can't abandon safety. Now, safety in our traditional forms of tangible physical safety are being challenged by the cyber domain and by the activities that occur through it. And that's a whole, again, a kind of a separate discussion about trying to modernize with that. Some people, you see it as a more nuanced approach. I tend to just see it as a more balanced approach. For those who are into sports, it's sort of like hedging your bets, right? So if we can't stop all of these threats, does that mean all Americans go, that's it, I'm done, I'll be, you know, I'll join, you know, North Korea or no, right? But we want to make sure that we have the tools and we have the people prepared to show that resistance before, you know, something like that happens. We want to have that show of resistance and fierce independence. That means that no matter how many or who or threatens you, it's not going to matter to who and what we are here. We're going to stay steadfast to the Constitution, to our representative democracy, to our ideals, such that we continue to share them across the country, which is, of course, what I'm talking about. We got to fix the lice infestation first. I do think we focus more on, obviously, the hunter, protector, defender side, and think that that safety is what still is going to trickle down and provide us with the security. I actually think if we had that security, we would be demanding less work of our defense infrastructure in providing us with safety, because there would be a higher tolerance for the noise. Just because some other country in the world is a rising economic or geopolitical power in that sphere doesn't mean it has anything to do with our security. Does it have to do with our economy? Yeah. With our foreign policies? Absolutely. With our concern about safety? Maybe. But it doesn't have anything to do with our security. You know, I think that being able to ask that question when Iran or North Korea or China or Russia, when they say blah, blah, blah about the United States, we say, okay, how does that affect our choice to be a democratic government? How does that affect our choice to remain loyal to the Constitution? You know, if it does, then we address it, but it probably isn't going to. And it seems like a simple thing, but it's an incredibly difficult, you know, it's such a challenge. And because we haven't really done it that way, it's hard to prove the theory. And I think that's, you know, one of the ways I'm continuing to do, you know, in my research is, you know, how do you show the case study for this?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's very helpful. So digging into some recent current events applying sort of this hypothesis. Recent events across the world, such as current conflicts in both Ukraine and Gaza and Israel, to my mind, show how relevant this extra layer of thinking about security is, both from the skills the individuals use, as well as the environments of security we construct on a larger scale. So how do we apply this mindset to think about crises all over the world, even ones that don't include a direct attack on American soil?
Yeah, no, thank you. That's a great question. I would say, I would look at it from two perspectives. One is the more conceptual, strategic, grand strategic perspective, and the other is, more tactical. At the grand strategic level, again, very simplistic, but I always like to start with kind of the extreme or the ideal. If every country was not afraid of another country invading it, fear, Thucydides, if they could, if they felt secure in who and what they were and safe enough, then there would be less reaction to provocations. If you think about it, if every country lived in utopia, every country was secure in their government and their governance and who they are and what they are and what they contribute in the world and what they get out of the world, then the prevalence of conflict would be much lower. There just wouldn't be the same kind of need, according to Thucydides. Fear, honor, interest. So that's the sort of grand conceptual stage. If Palestinian people were secure in who they were, and obviously there's a safety issue there too. Same for the Israelis. If they were secure in who they are, and maybe the safety threats wouldn't matter as much. Russia, if Putin and the Russians would be happy with the country that they are and not need to appropriate everybody else. I know this is terrible, but it does remind me of the sort of controlling parent who needs every member of the family as part of the family business. That's not happiness. But at any rate, Iran, Saudi Arabia, just take any North Korea, South Korea, take any situation. And if there were more security inward, there would be less need for the outward safety. So I do think it has applications at a strategic level. Now, at a more tactical level, I get back to, let's take some of those lessons that occurred, the survival strategies that occurred in the domicile, and put them into play here in a more tactical way. One thing, I should have mentioned this earlier, but one thing that has been really advanced by the intersection of neuroscience and anthropology is understanding how the typical, and here I will talk gender, but the typical female brain reacts versus the typical male brain in to perceived threat. And, you can read The Female Brain by Dr. Brizendine and, and others about this, but the end of the story is the female brain, whether it's in a female or a woman or, somebody else, the female brain has a tendency to avoid conflict. And there's a whole host of reasons for it, largely because for 500,000 years or 488,000 of those 500,000 years, arguably, you could still say today, getting in a conflict with someone who is stronger than you isn't going to end well for you. Well before just theory was ever created and the idea of not a just war if it's a war you can't win, gatherers and caretakers and women knew this already. We didn't need Aquinas or Augustine to come up with it. So you don't get involved in a conflict that you can't win. But what that evolutionary process does with that is create innovative thinking about other ways to get out of a conflict. And so I think that is what we need now. It just automatically escalates to this ratcheting up of violence, of deterrence and projection of violence. Whereas, again, going back to the influence side, right? Personally, if I were empress of the world for a day, I would look at what's happening in Israel and Palestine is an opportunity to find the Palestinian voice, out of the Palestinian people. My ideal situation would be a press conference with a sampling of Palestinians from Gaza and the West Bank, different ages, both men and women, boys and girls, teachers, nurses, whatever, just a huge collection of people, and ask them what they want. Have the conversation and start building on the common interests and ignore the terrorists. Ignore, frankly, in many ways, the Israeli Defense Forces too. Just have conversations between the people and find that there are a lot of shared interests and shared values. Start to neutralize the threats from a conceptual perspective and build instead on where you can where you can create that little baby steps of influence. The thing with terrorist groups is their only real fear is of being irrelevant. They seek glory through martyrdom. It doesn't matter what kind of terrorist group you are, you know, your mythology increases if you're killed in battle, so to speak. But to be ignored, to be sidelined, that is defeat for a terrorist organization. And, you know, I've always said that having observed terrorist groups since the Cold War, you know, the Red Army factions and Bader Meinhof and all those others, all terrorist groups that I've ever analyzed commit the same first crime, and that's theft, because they steal a legitimate grievance on the part of a population and they appropriate it for themselves, and they become self-declared champions of that grievance. And then these poor people with legitimate grievances, and there are legitimate grievances on both sides of every conflict, poor people with the legitimate grievances are left either having terrorist group champion them or the rest of the world ignoring them because the rest of the world doesn't want to seem like it's kowtowing to terrorists. But there is another way. You know, there is building the bridge through conversation. And I'll tell you what, talking is cheap, doesn't cost much, slow risk. You get a lot more out of that communication than you think, just like our gatherer caretakers got a lot more out of communication with a baby that can't speak. You know, there's a lot more that goes on in the communication of a household, the influence arena, and also just the concept and how you define the goals and where you want to go and how you get there is a much more patient approach. But again, I argue it will last a lot longer. And those are the sort of tactical pieces that we don't ever apply in this kind of conflict or crisis.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. That's great. Thank you. So a lot of what you wrote, and this is getting on maybe the individual conceptualization of this mindset, of this framework, a lot of what you wrote about in your book and talked about at your workshop that I attended was how important taking time for proper reflection to understand and to better react after maybe a volatile incident occurs, and then to empathize to some extent with adversaries and honestly communicate what we think is best despite the potential difficulties that might entail. These skills are essential for U.S. security and global success for the United States in achieving its goals, like you literally just mentioned, so touching on exactly what you talked about. So a lot of those skills to me sounds a lot like emotional intelligence. Would that be fair to say?
Yes. I mean, I think it's, you know, there's a lot of different labels for them, I know. But absolutely, emotional intelligence, you know, anything with the word emotion seems to be dismissed in the national security space because somehow or another, anger and fear aren't classified as emotions. I don't understand that. I think that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. But, you know, again, I go back to sort of the typical hunter brain and the typical gatherer brain because they are anatomically quite different. And they are functionally quite different too. You know, what you get with the female brain is a larger prefrontal cortex and a larger, I think it's the anterior cingulate cortex. So you have executive functioning and critical thinking, and you have a much larger hippocampus where memory is stored. And all of that ends up creating, again, according to Dr. Brizendine's research and others, creates a functioning that is quite sophisticated in the sense of the larger hippocampus stores so much more memory, which is data to draw on, right? So it's data, like our 4,000 years of written history. It's so much more data to draw on. And women have more mirroring neurons, which allows them to pick up those body language and physical cues that are so much more subtle. And so you have a tremendous amount of data, and you have an executive functioning brain that knows to like draw on that data, and a critical thinking brain that knows how to forecast from that data, which is why women are often, well, I'm sure it's why we were considered witches back in the day, because we could predict the future. You know, from that, you have this ability to forecast, to reflect, to think about a lot of alternative futures that might come out of a situation, and a pretty quick processing system that helps you with that. And also, of course, that instinctive, is this a conflict on the physical sense that is winnable, right? Mm-hmm. So Do I have to go into my more creative thinking? Whereas on the, you know, on the other side, you have a larger amygdala, which is where violence and anger and all of that, you know, is produced. And then less capable when it comes to mirroring neurons, a smaller prefrontal cortex, a smaller, you know, critical thinking spot. That doesn't mean that they aren't capable, but anatomically, this is what you get. That instinct to approach, you know, something with that appears to be a threat with violence and anger on one side versus the instinct to chew on it for a while, which is what Dr. Brizendine called it, you know, like this, like a second stomach. We have a second brain that's like chewing on this for a while. In national security parlance, that is considered indecisiveness or, you know, conflict avoidant. It's considered weakness. But I see those as evolutionary skills, not soft skills, not necessarily emotional intelligence, but evolutionary thinking, evolutionary power even, because they are born out of evolution. Clearly, in order to have a different brain, we have faced different types of threats in various kinds of contexts, and we don't. So we need to be able to leverage that instinctive response, because you're not going to be able to blow up malign influence, I don't think. We're going to have to leverage something else.
Yeah, no, that's really encouraging to hear, especially for people who might lean a different direction in the way that they think and the way they react to things and perhaps think that that's not correct or not right or what's needed in a certain situation. That's nice to hear there's a place for that. That's very valuable, very beneficial.
I think there is. Mm-hmm. I don't know that, you know, this is one of the things is, you know, getting the national security apparatus and the people in it to begin to embrace that is very difficult. It's also difficult because we don't have the conversation with the American people, because when you're in that apparatus, and believe me, I've felt it, you feel the weight of the world on your shoulders, and you don't want the next attack or event to occur on your watch. Mm-hmm. And in part because you know the American people will not accept it. So I'm not saying that we want to accept attacks. I'm just saying if we had more of an honest conversation about what is possible, because we could create a prison out of our society. You know, we could imprison this country and, you know, be the thought police and everything else, but we're still going to be threatened. You know, there are murders in prison. So, but without that conversation to release some of the pressure on the national security apparatus, it's very difficult for them to take their eye off of that ball.
Yeah, that's important to remember. So since a lot of our audience are early in career, hopeful professionals in the national security space, how do you think they can practice or cultivate this kind of concept that you're talking about and to address national security issues in a way that might have been ignored thus far in their education?
Right. Yeah. No. And I mean, I think this is why it's important to focus on the roles. You know, we know these are roles that contributed to security, to societal prosperity, well before the agrarian revolution. They continued after the agrarian revolution. They just weren't as transparently, you know, seen, and eventually they weren't retrospectively through written history valued as equally. I don't believe that as soon as we became settled societies, we stopped valuing what was happening in a private domicile. It's the recording of it, the recording of history that was really largely about what happened in the public space by the men in the public spaces that skewed what we think now. But I don't think we should lose sight of the difference between our explanation and actuality. So at no point in time has what gatherer, caretaker, provider, planners do ever been less important than what hunter, protector, defenders do. They're different, but we couldn't exist without these roles. And so I think focusing on the roles as opposed to the assignment of them historically by birth sex or the gendering of them through narratives, you know, the words like softer and, you know, that is not helpful. It's these just pure roles that we engage in contributing to the endurance of the human race, our ability to coexist on this earth, both with the earth and with each other, and our well-being and prosperity during that period of time, not just our safety. That, I think, is important. And, you know, one of the things I do think, you know, just looking at my own children and some of the, you know, so many of the students that I've had the opportunity to engage with at Georgetown and elsewhere is, I think, coming out of COVID, which, you know, robbed so many young people of 2 years, at least, of normalcy, of, you know, social development in a way that the rest of us had experienced. I honestly see a lot of silver linings that come out of that. And one of them is an increased willingness and determination to normalize discussion of mental well-being, of mental health and just well-being. That's not being lazy. Wanting to be able to balance your life is not laziness. I mean, shoot, it takes most of us till retirement age to realize that we screwed up. I think, you know, there's more conversation about, you know, how do I achieve a better balance? And that balance includes, how am I more engaged at home? You know, whether it's just my private life on my own and other activities in the world or friendships, or whether it's relationships or children or whatever it might be. But it's realizing that I want it to be transparent again. I want to be back in that hunter-gatherer lifestyle of it's all balanced and it's shared in a way that is transparent. You know, I don't build up resentment that I'm over here stuck doing this and you build up resentment over here because you're stuck doing that. So that makes me very hopeful, because I feel like hunter-gatherer paradigm is going to immediately and intuitively feel more relevant to a generation than it has passed in my generation. That gives me hope.
Yeah, same. So, final question for you, Professor. You strike me as someone that a lot of people, including myself, can really relate to. You seem to be drawn to sort of both sides of the equation of the hunter and gatherer pathways to security. So what made you decide to join the national security industry through the IC in particular, rather than something that aligns more with maybe a gatherer role? And to take the question even further, would you say there's a place for application of this kind of caretaker-gatherer thinking, even in these traditional security environments?
Yes, absolutely. Let me answer the latter question first, because absolutely. I mean, I wrote an op-ed, I think it was last year, it was published out in Idaho, about how America needs a caretaker. And again, it wasn't about female or male. It was about someone who was going to nurture and reshape America's thinking about itself, because we've become so divided, because we, you know, are so diverse in our cultures and our histories and our backgrounds that we've lost track of how do we make an old narrative that was kind of exclusive and elitist and turn it into one that we can all share and find ourselves in. Again, because I feel like that projection of power is absolutely linked to our influence abroad and the perception of our economic well-being and stability, and political stability. So they're not separate. So I do think caretaker thinking about that priority, how is it going to affect how we get to decide or how we think of ourselves in national security spaces? I think there's room for that. I also think it's important, though, that those arenas, again, I'd like to continue to advance this theory. And as you see, perhaps the Department of Education, for example, becoming a conversation in national security discussions that it's really not right now, except for when it involves terrorism and radicalization. So, like, thinking about it from a perspective of they're the builders of national security. They're growing the most important skill set of Americans in national security. So it is going to take, I think, some cross-pollinization, where you have people who come from an educational background, who come from other, you know, communication, marketing, PR, all that media, who have more, are able to contribute to discussions about building of security, and people who come from this side in those places too. So there's a, like I said, cross-pollinization. So I do think there's more room for it. I also think it's important to not think about these roles as being personified. So even though I call them hunter-gatherer, and I know that automatically kind of personifies them, of course, women were also big game hunters, which our anthropologists are now discovering as well, because an individual like myself can be both a hunter and a gatherer. I was very much a hunter at work, hunter, protector, defender. Well, you ask my kids, some of them would say I was pretty ruthless in my parenting too. But, you know, I know how to be the gatherer, caretaker, and certainly the strategic planner on this side. And those things to me are really, again, I think I'm in the nomadic hunter-gatherer world where it was all kind of out in the open and transparent, and it integrated and flowed together. The complementary nature of these things was much more self-evident. I feel like because I had the chaos at home and the chaos at work, it's much more self-evident to me too. So I think that's important. It's really obviously very important. I have three boys, two girls. It's really important for men to not feel like they're being, you know, emasculated by having gatherer tendencies or caretaker tendencies. You know, it's also important for women to not feel like they're being masculine or masculinized or militarized, as they so often say, by having a hunter, protector, defender focus. These are all security and survival needs.
Yeah. So thank you again for donating your time to the podcast today. I know if our listeners were anything like me after your workshop, they're going to be thinking about your ideas for quite a while. Are there any last remarks you'd like to leave with us?
Yeah. I mean, I think perhaps one of the, you know, step back thoughts to remember is, and I think, you know, this comes out in my initial book, although I don't think I was thinking ahead about this kind of idea, but we still today very much think what happens in the family setting, the home setting, and in the privacy of our space is wholly separate what happens when we scale up, whether it's to a broader family base, a community, or your town, your city, your state, your country, the world. And I don't think it does. And if you start to just recognize that everything that happens, all of the tensions, all of the definitions, the concepts, the approaches, your solutions, all of those things that happen in that space, whether it's between you and yourself or you and a handful of other people in your family, for example, those things have applications when you scale them up. It isn't just about some, you know, headless government somewhere, or, you know, the military or the police or, you know, Homeland Security. It really is as relevant there as it is at home.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Professor, so much for coming out and talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I really do appreciate this opportunity, because I know it's quite, this theory, this paradigm is quite different. And I am, like, as I said, I still have a lot of research to do. So at this point, I would pose it as a hypothesis, or, you know, a budding theory. So I do appreciate, you know, folks' interest in it. Obviously, any students who want to email me know how to find me. So please feel free. I try to be as available to everyone in SSP as I possibly can.
Absolutely.
So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all of our listeners out there. This is the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review. As a reminder, the views expressed on this podcast are the views of the participants alone and do not represent the views or opinions of Georgetown University, the Precision Guided Podcast, or any other agency. Thank you for listening to the Precision Guided Podcast. Follow the Georgetown Security Studies Review on social media to stay up to date on the latest Precision Guided Podcast episodes and GSSR content. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, or you can visit our website at georgetownsecuritystudiesreview.org.